Good morning, everybody. This is Jim Bianco. Thanks for joining us on our monthly conference call. A couple of housekeeping items. We're doing this call duly over the phone and as a webcast. So some of you that will hear me speak, you might hear me make some references to the webcast, but I'll try and do it in such a way that you will be able to follow me either way. There is a handout for some of you that don't have the handout. You can send an email to Ryan Malo in our office, and he'll shoot you a copy. It's rmalo@biancoresearch.com, and he'll send you a copy over straightforward. Okay, today the latest on credit and deleveraging. And if you turn to page 2, I'll talk a little bit about the summary and conclusion up front. Beginning of the end. I wrote this back in September, and I've been repeating this ever since. I still believe we are in the final capitulation process. It's the beginning of the end. At September, I wrote, within the next 3 months, the low price and the high spread should be in place. I still think that right now. Now, does that mean technically that we're within days of it? I don't know if we're within days of it or a couple weeks of it or a couple months, but I do think that what we're seeing now is the final capitulation process. A couple of interesting notes here about, let me use the stock market as a measure. If the stock market closes here at 783, where it is as I'm talking, the Dow down 166 points, the S&P 500 at 783, it's only 6 points above its 2002 low, which was 776. And being that it is only it's only 6 points below its 2002 low, it's also more than 50% off of its high, which would make this the largest high-to-low sell-off in the stock market since the Great Depression or since the 1930s. That has a enormous amount of damage being done, at least to the equity valuations. To cut the stock market in half, more than cut it in half, for the first time since the 1930s. We went down 49% both in 1974 and 49% again in 2002. If we close at current levels, we would be more than 50% off of the highs right now. That's why I think that we might be in the process of the final capitulation, the beginning of the end, where we are going to put in the low price and the high yield, or the high spread. But, as I've also tried to argue too, over the next several months, I do not think that the market's going to have much in the way of a recovery, no V bottom. Why no V bottom? I've argued that this is a political argument more than anything else. If we are going to punish risk-taking, if we are going to cap salaries, if we are going to make nationalize whole swaths of the financial industry, maybe the auto industry, and continue on down the line, we are going to take risk-taking out of the system. We don't want people to lose money, so don't take a risk. And if there is no risk, there is no reward, so that really limits the ability of the market to recover. So I think we make the low here, because I think we've done so much damage to the market. The last warning I would give you is I've also been saying, too, I would rather be a month late than a month early. So even though we might be a few weeks or a few months from the low, ultimately, because I think what we're going to have is a big capitulation, I don't want to buy now. I would rather buy a month after the low. I'd rather say that was the low. It's now being confirmed by some technical indicators, now going higher. It's a, you know, in the trader parlance, it's a better buy higher. Let the market bottom out. Let the market go back up. And then at that point, I could then consider trying to buy the market and looking for it to move higher along the way. So that's kind of where I am as far as where the market is. The three other topics I want to address with this is the government, the amount of government intervention. Everything stopped in October. I want to talk about how horrifically bad the fourth quarter is shaping up to be economically. And then I want to give an update on where the credit markets stand in the deleveraging. And the answer is, it's real hard to make a case that the credit markets were getting better. We were looking at some markets that were being manipulated through heavy government intervention, namely commercial paper and LIBOR, and convincing ourselves they were getting better. But the fact of the matter is, beyond those markets, it's real hard to make that case. And finally, as far as deleveraging goes, I know that's a big popular question everybody tries to ask. I don't think there's been a lot of deleveraging that's been happening. What's been happening is the private sector has been delevering, and the government sector or the public sector has been trying to take up the slack. The great example of that is the auto companies. Deleveraging means people go out of business. Deleveraging means people stop borrowing. You want a great example of deleveraging? Close the auto companies. No, we can't close the auto companies, so we're going to have the government give them a loan. So overall, we're not deleveraging at all. We're just switching some of the leverage to the government. And that gets back to my thesis that as we switch it to the government, there will be a need to put in laws in place so that we don't take risks, and that's going to prevent any kind of a decent rally in the market. So let's start on page 3. Let's talk a little bit about the government's intervention. Here's a table I found on CNBC. Looked right to me. How much money has been thrown at the financial crisis to date? We are fond of saying that this financial crisis has always been about numbers so large nobody understands them. And right now, if you look at this table on page 3, what you'll see is that the total number is $4.2 trillion. $4.2 trillion. The earliest that all of these things that are listed on this sheet came into play would be the discount window lending. The first set of rules were moved in favor of the commercial banks back in August of 2007. So a little bit over 15 months, we have spent $4 trillion. Now, what is that number? How do I put that number in context? On the right, I show a bunch of big budget items on the right. And a bunch of those big budget items, the amount of outlays we have is larger than all of these combined. The Marshall Plan, the Louisiana Purchase, the Race to the Moon, the S&L crisis, North Korean War, the New Deal, the Gulf War, the Vietnam War, and NASA without the Race to the Moon combined. We've outlaid more money than all of that combined. All of those items collectively total $3.92 trillion in inflation-adjusted dollars versus $4.28 trillion. So you'd have another $359 billion left over after all of that. Now, it's important to note that what we're doing is largely loans. We should get paid back. The recovery rate is not zero in a lot of these cases. The recovery rate is something a little bit higher than zero, but nevertheless, the outlays are greater than all of those. The only comparable thing that we have seen in American history, I was going to say human history, but let's just go with American history, is the cost of World War II on an inflation-adjusted basis. It was $3.6 trillion. These are numbers that are so large that we have a very difficult time understanding these numbers. The amount of money thrown at this crisis is unprecedented in American history for anything that we've ever done. And anytime you see numbers or you see statements where people say, well, we need to throw another $500 billion there, or maybe it'll cost another $1 trillion here, they're making them up. These numbers are so big, nobody understands them to begin with. And it shows you the amount of push by the federal government in particular the U.S. government in this case, in order to stem this crisis. And this chart on page 3 is my example that I also like to use to talk a little bit about how we are not delevering. You could look at this table and say that all of these numbers in total are the amount of private sector delevering that was about to occur, but the federal government wouldn't allow it to occur, so they stepped into the breach where people couldn't get loans. Not getting loans is another definition of delevering, and then started handing out those loans to somebody else. Before I move on, let me go to the next page, or before I make some more qualitative comments and go to the next page. The amount of losses to date, and hopefully those of you on the webcast can read these numbers. So far, the amount of losses to date that the banks, the insurance companies, and the GSEs have written off is $967 billion, almost $1 trillion. The the chart on page 4 in red shows the losses, and in blue shows capital raised. The total amount of capital raised has been $829 billion, or $830 if you round it off. Now, I've argued that the amount of capital raised, losses minus capital raised, is the measure that you want to look at as far as delevering goes. And if you look at these numbers nominally, you say, okay, we're net down about $150 billion. The number that I've been using all along has been a leverage ratio of about 14 to 1. So if you're net down $150 billion times 14 to 1, that means that the financial system by this measure is about $2 trillion smaller than it was, that it's about $2 trillion smaller than it was about a year ago or 18 months ago. However, if you look at the fourth quarter, $378.7 billion was raised. That's the big blue bar on the chart. That means that we've had almost $400 billion of capital injections come in to the financial system in the fourth quarter. The majority of that number, $221 billion of it, has come in through TARP money. The table that's on the left there, and I tried to lay it out so it was large enough to read on the printed copy, shows you all of the banks and AIG being the only non-bank right at the top of the list, AIG at the top, that have received commitments for TARP money and have publicly stated it. It's 92 financial institutions totaling $221 billion. The Treasury does not make this data available. The companies or the banking system, the banks that borrow this money eventually make it public either through a press release or through their financial statements. So I've totaled this up from several sources that have been trying to count up these numbers, and this number pretty much agrees with everybody else's source. Mine's a little larger because I'm combining everybody's source. But so 221 of the 378 is TARP money. And what have we heard about TARP money? We've heard that the banks aren't lending that out. So when you look at this difference of $967 billion in losses versus $829 of capital raised, bear in mind that a couple of hundred billion dollars of that capital raised is TARP money that's not being lent out. So there's been a massive shrinkage in the financial system. A massive shrinkage that has led to the financial sector delevering, but the government won't allow the consequences of delevering because the consequences, again, are auto companies, you can't get a loan, you have to go out of business. Well, no, we're going to give them a loan. Commercial paper market, you can cease to exist, so GE, you cannot roll over your commercial paper. Oh, hold on a minute, the Fed will take care of that, and we'll continue to let them borrow directly from the Fed. So that's what deleveraging means, and we're not allowing that to happen. Page 5 is the update of the 3 months to remember. We've been keeping track of what I subjectively thought that in a normal year would be events that would be one of the bigger financial events of the year in a normal year. And I've been tracking them since Labor Day, and I've got 101 entries right now since Labor Day. Unbelievable what the government has been doing. And I think that this has been somewhat counterproductive. Now, not all of these are government moves, but most of them are. And I think it's been somewhat counterproductive that at this point, I think we should step back and we can argue whether or not the government's moves to date have been effective. We're not sure whether or not they've been effective. Paul McCulley in his latest said he doesn't know whether or not the Fed or the government allowing Lehman Brothers to fail made the situation worse. I'll agree with that. We don't know. We don't know what it would have been had they bailed out, what would have happened. We don't. So we're left to guess. But if the answer is we don't know what happened, if the answer is we're not sure, then let's stop changing the rules every 5 minutes with these 101 types of things. I think that that has done more damage than anything else. As far as the Lehman situation goes, I would argue that it's a much larger situation than Lehman. During the first half of September, the federal government, either the Treasury or the Federal Reserve, put Fannie and Freddie into conservatorship, and then made the decision to bankrupt the preferred holders. So we gave the death penalty to some stockholders, preferred stockholders. Then we gave the death penalty to some firms in the case of Lehman Brothers. But other firms we extorted in the case of AIG. The Fed gave them a loan, but they had to give the Fed warrants for 80% ownership of the company. The Fed is the lender of last resort, not the extortioner of last resort. I've never heard of the Fed giving out a loan and demanding ownership in a company before. Then if you want to throw in the FDIC, WaMu, which was owned by TPG, was in the process of trying to find a buyer. In the middle of that process, the FDIC said, you know what, this isn't going to work. You're not going to find a buyer here. We're just going to give the company to So we've bankrupted firms, we picked winners, we picked losers, we extorted firms, and we forcibly took firms and given them to other people. Why do you think the markets panicked in the first half of September and haven't stopped since? Because we've been treating the owners of financial firms as badly as any time in probably capitalist history in this country. And they don't know, owners of financial firms don't know whether it's their firm, it's the government's firm, the government's going to bankrupt them, the government's going to leave them alone, the government's going to give their firm to somebody else because they don't like the way they're operating it, in the case of WaMu. We don't, you know, the government's going to forcibly give them capital like they did with the top nine firms and then maybe demand that they run their business in a certain way, like restrict the bonuses that they give. This is why these financial firms have been under such tremendous stress, I think, and that if anything, we could call a timeout on what they've been doing as far as everything. And I think that to some extent, after Paulson's latest blunder, where he all but admitted that the original TARP plan to put a reverse auction to put a floor on mortgage securities is not going to happen, we're seeing the consequence of that in the MBX or the ABX and the CMBX markets. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But if we go to page six, just to finish off with the government's extraordinary involvement in the markets. Here I want to detail what the Fed has been doing to its balance sheet. In the upper left corner of the chart, it shows that the Fed's balance sheet has gone from $880 billion to almost $2.2 trillion in the space of a little over 2 months, an unprecedented move at any time since the Fed was created in 1913. Now, how did the Fed explode their balance sheet that much? The upper right chart shows the total system repos and term auction facilities, or TAFs, outstanding. The TAF only became in existence in late December, and we're now up to almost $500 billion, $495 billion. So that's a quarter of the Fed's balance sheet right there. Another big part of the Fed's balance sheet in the lower left is Treasury securities lent by the Fed. That used to be a nominal amount of $5 or $6 billion. That's now $220 billion. The Fed has also been trying to sterilize these operations. Back when their balance sheet was $880 billion, if you look at the lower right chart, 90-plus percent of their balance sheet was Treasury securities. Now it's down to 22% is Treasury securities. Let's jump to the next page on page 7. And on page 7, you'll see a detailed breakdown of the discount window borrowing by the Fed. The bank borrowed $95 billion in total. If you look at the table, $322 billion has been borrowed through the discount window, through all of these various facilities that are being listed. $322 has been borrowed as far as the Fed goes. So $500 billion from the TAF, $220 billion through the Treasury securities operations. $322 trillion has been borrowed through the discount window. Now, remember, all of these are collateralized loans. This means that they've put collateral up there at the Fed of some kind of security and got a loan back well over $1 trillion. Some of you have been following this. Bloomberg is suing the Fed, trying to get disclosure as to what the collateral is that has been put up, this $1 trillion worth of collateral. The Fed is not relenting. They don't want us to know what the collateral is. The fear is that a lot of this collateral is worth a lot less than the face amount, and that the Fed could be sitting on sizable losses. Look at what CMBX and ABX have just done in the last couple of weeks. That kind of stuff is the collateral that's being put up at the Fed. They could be sitting on huge losses. Remember that Maiden Lane, which was the entity that they for the $30 billion loan to get J.P. Morgan to buy Bear Stearns, there's $30 billion worth of collateral. They've already marked that collateral down by about 9%, but they still won't tell us what that collateral is. Well, if you take it and you mark it through all of this stuff, the Fed could be sitting on another 90-ish billion dollars worth of losses just by that measure, and that's before the big dive that we've had in the last couple of weeks. But the bottom line with all these first set of charts is to just detail the extraordinary government intervention that's been going on. The takeaway, these numbers are too big to understand when anybody says we need to have another $1 trillion or something like that. We've already got more than World War II committed to this in just the last year. These are numbers that are being made up. You know, you could say to $1 trillion, or you could say $100 trillion. It doesn't mean anything to anybody as far as these numbers go. This is extraordinarily inflationary, what we're seeing happen. But because it's not working, what we're having is deflation. I always like to kid around, be careful if the Fed ever did work and we ever did see traction being taken and we ever did see that the credit crisis, we were getting behind it. Because if we did, we would see these markets take off and we would see inflation come back in a big way. But since we're not seeing inflation come back in a big way, rather what we're seeing happen is we're seeing that what we're seeing is deflation in its place. So all of these moves combined with the stock market sell-off, which has now reached epic proportions, if we jump to page 8, has had a tremendous impact on the economy. Page 8, what I show here on page 8 is just some measures of the economy, just a couple of measures. In the upper left corner, I show consumer confidence. This chart goes back to 1967. It's a 40-year chart. We have the lowest consumer confidence ever recorded. The dive between September at 61.4 to October at 38 is the biggest one-month decline in consumer confidence's history. So consumer confidence is in the tank. Auto sales underneath it. Auto sales took one of their biggest dives to 30% down between September and October. That's the biggest monthly decline in auto sales in the post-World War II period, and auto sales are now at the lowest levels they've been in 18 years, and when we get November's numbers, from every indication from the auto companies, is it's going to be far worse. Housing starts in the upper right. Housing starts came out yesterday morning at 791,000 or 791,500 units. That is the lowest monthly rate of housing starts ever. We have the highest number of homes, of households in the country. There's 122 million households in the country. You go back 40, 50, 60 years when we had 70 or 80 million households in the country, and you still had a higher number of housing starts going on. This is the lowest number ever. And the dive between September and October was one of the biggest ever. ISM in the lower right corner, the Institute of Supply Management's national index from 49.9 to 39.9, a 26-year low and one of the biggest dives ever. You could add into that, into these numbers, initial unemployment claims, which has taken a sharp move higher, up to 542,000, up 37,000 today as well, too. And when you look at all of these numbers, what you're looking at is an economy, real GDP growth, which could be nothing short of a disaster for the fourth quarter. Now, why a disaster? It's been apparent, and I've written about this a number of times in our News Clips product, that it seems like around the time that the TARP was passed, and we had the stock market fall 3,000 points in a week, ending October 10th, which was its worst weekly loss since 1932, worst week in 75 years, that it scared the hell out of everybody and everything stopped. People that had the capacity to buy things or can conduct business activity decided to stop in around the first week of October because they wanted to wait to see what was going to happen. In other words, they're looking for a sign that things are getting better. We were thinking maybe that sign was going to be Obama's acceptance speech on November 4th. But in the 3 days after that acceptance speech, the stock market lost another 1,000 points. So that kind of put a kibosh on that. So it seems like where the economists are having problems with the economy in the fourth quarter is people have the capacity to spend the money. They've elected to not spend the money. And these economic numbers and a lot of others are just showing that everything stopped in October. That when you look at economic numbers, if it has September or August on it, you can forget those. That was the old world. We want to look at October at economic numbers that have October and November on them, and those are very bad. And economists have a problem getting their arms around this because they think that at any moment, and it's true, at any moment these people could start spending again because they have the capacity to do it. But I don't think they're going to do it until they're given a sign, some kind of sign, that things are better. And I don't know what that sign is. I don't know what that sign is right now, that things are going to get better, but yet we wait. The newest argument that I've heard is that it might be January 20th with the acceptance speech. The problem with that is we got two more months to go through with this. That means that we'll have one of the worst GDP numbers in the fourth quarter if we continue through the rest of the year like that. We'll have a terrible Christmas selling season, and by January 20th, we'll be in the midst of year-end financials and fourth quarter financials that are going to be scaring everybody to death. And then at that point, I don't know if an acceptance speech is going to be able to turn it around. The consequence to all of this is the chart on page 9. The chart on page 9 is something we've been highlighting about. It's all the same trade. On the top panel on page 9, you've got the S&P 500 repeated twice. As you move down the panel, you've got emerging market stocks in the left in the second panel in Brazil, emerging market bonds next to it, and investment-grade bonds, investment-grade OAS plotted inversely underneath that, the euro next to that, the CRB index, the Baltic Dry Freight Index, bond market volatility in the move, and stock market volatility in the VIX. I could have picked a whole bunch of other markets. I could have picked gold. I could have picked crude oil. I could have picked the yen. I could have added. But I randomly chose these markets because they covered a broad cross-section of what I was looking for. Emerging markets, developed markets, stocks, bonds, commodities. And on the chart, listed and on the chart, is the correlation to the S&P 500 over the previous 6 months. The chart on the right shows the market that is least correlated to the S&P. So every day I do think about it in the spreadsheet, a min calculation. What market's least correlated to the S&P, and I plot that. Right now, the least correlated market to the S&P over the last 6 months has been the MOVE Index at 83%. That is the highest we've seen in 10 years, and if you look at the way that these numbers are unfolding, it looks like it's going to stay that way for a while right now. All the markets are trading the same. So when we look at crude oil trading below $50 a barrel today, at least on Brent crude oil, $51 on WTI, and then we try to make the case that crude oil was a bubble at 147, that inventories are growing, it's all the same thing. If the stock market were to make a V-bottom and rally sharply higher, crude oil is going up with it too. As long as the market slumps and stays low, everybody's going to stay afraid, and crude oil is going to go down. The good news is you can buy cheaper gas. It's coming soon at the gas station at the corner. The bad news is hopefully you still have a job to be able to pay for gas. That's kind of what the crude oil argument is. It is all the same trade, and trying to differentiate what's happening with the euro, what's happening with crude oil, the Baltic Dry Index, stock market volatility, bond market volatility, at this moment, you don't need to differentiate it because we're all operating on whether or not this credit crisis is going to get worse are going to get better, and it's driving all the markets the same. And right now, the fear is it's going to get worse because of the very bad fourth quarter economic numbers and all of that massive government intervention, which is greater than World War II collectively, so far hasn't really been working. Page 10, let's talk about where we are in the crisis. These charts here are of the ABX and the CMBX. On the upper left on the chart is the ABX index, and the lower right on the chart is the CMBX index. These are the AAA prices on these indexes. What I tried to highlight on a couple of these charts on the ABX index in blue, I got November 5th, November 10th, and on the CMBX index in red, I highlighted November 10th and November 18th. I wanted to show you how badly these prices have gone down in just the last 2 weeks, that this move down in the ABX and in the CMBX is greater than any other move we've seen in the history of these indices. And you can see that these charts go back, in the ABX case, back to January of 07, and in the CMBX into May of 07. The worst move down in securities backed by mortgages and commercial real estate mortgages has been in the last 2 weeks. This market is getting worse. It's not getting better. What happened in the last 2 weeks? It appears that these guys believed that there was a program called TARP that was going to do reverse auctions, that was going to put a floor on their prices. And while the initial move in TARP was to put some capital out to the banks, they were eventually going to get around to doing that. When Paulson announced beginning of last week, no, we're not going to do that, these prices fell apart. They were artificially inflated with the hope that government money was coming. And when he changed his view that we weren't going to do this program, these markets took another dramatic turn downward. And so it shows me a couple of things. One, Paulson still has a tin ear as to what's been happening in the marketplace. He had no idea how much these prices were being held up by the hope that TARP money was coming in the original plan of the reverse auction. And when he pulled it back, he made the situation much worse. And that's why, like I said earlier, let's just call it timeout. No more new plans, because all these plans collectively aren't doing anything. And in the case of this, sometimes they make things worse. So I don't think that these situations are definitely going to help. So when we talk about, is credit getting better? The original ground for credit is is real estate, securities backed by commercial and residential real estate. These markets are decidedly getting worse. Oh, but wait, there are markets that are getting better. And those markets I like to call the medicated markets. One big thing you'll hear and you'll read every day, signs that the credit crisis are getting better, is that LIBOR is coming down. The chart, the top left in red, LIBOR peaked at 481 in early October or mid-October. It's gone all the way down to 222. The bottom, the green chart underneath, that shows the difference between three-month LIBOR and three-month Treasuries, or the TED spread. That got to an unbelievable record of 436 basis points by October 14th. But now at 211, why we want to say that's better, other than the last 2 months, that's right where we were at every other panic point during this crisis. 211 basis points was considered a panic on the TED spread up until 2 months ago. Then we went to 436, and I guess we redefined what the definition of panic is. And what I'm trying to say here is that LIBOR is still telling us that there's big problems. You could see that, especially if you look at the blue line on the top, which is three-month Treasury bills. That's something that everybody can watch every day, three-month Treasury bills. You don't need to get as complicated as watching something like LIBOR. They were at 11 basis points on Tuesday's close. They're at 6 basis points now. They're effectively zero. These markets are getting better. Three-month bills are going to move dramatically higher, more towards the targeted funds rate of 1%. This market has come down, as I've talked about in the text on the right, is 9 of the 16 banks that report to LIBOR have received government money. Some of them are UK banks and European banks, and they've gotten money from their governments as well, too. There have been public statements that they want these banks to do something about LIBOR. In fact, I linked it in the piece if you click on the link about doing something about LIBOR. Well, they did. They brought it down. You wanted it down, they brought it down. A lot of these banks aren't lending at these rates, so it's a number, you know, it's the, you know, LIBOR, the level you cannot get a loan at. And now it's 222. It used to be 481. And they're using other measures now, like CDS spreads and stuff, to price new loans with. But their new capital injection came from the government. The government wanted it lower, and they got it lower. That's why I was calling these medicated markets. If I'm in excruciating pain and you shoot me up with morphine, okay, I'm not in pain anymore, but that doesn't mean that my problem has gone away. And that's what we've done with markets like LIBOR, and if you look at the market or the chart on the next page, commercial paper, we've shot these markets full of morphine and they don't feel any more pain, and we've decided now that they're getting better. No, they're not getting better. The definition of getting better, to continue with my metaphor, is when you withdraw your medication that the patient doesn't go back into convulsions. So if you want to know a sign of when does LIBOR get better, when they start reducing the size of the TAF, when they start reducing the size of government involvement. If they, in terms of commercial paper, if the commercial paper right now, you can borrow 30-day commercial paper directly from the Fed once you're approved to borrow. That program is supposed to end in April. Well, end it in April, and let's see if the private market steps in and continues to let corporations borrow at that rate. And if they do, then the commercial paper market is getting better. If they extend it in April, well, then they answered the question. It's not getting better. We won't know until that happens. Nominally, as the chart in the upper left shows, nominally rates are coming down because they're government-set rates. Commercial paper rates are now no different than the targeted funds rate. The bottom chart shows the percentage of commercial paper, bottom left, the percentage of commercial paper that is being financed 4 days or less, that was running at around 80 or 90%. Then they started the program. It shot down to 20%, meaning 80% during the early part, late October, early November, 80% of all commercial paper was longer than 4 days. 80% of commercial paper was not overnight commercial paper. But now we're back to 90-plus percent of commercial paper is overnight. Nobody wants to give an extension of a loan beyond 4 days because of the environment we're in. The only lending that they got was the initial burst of lending that we saw when people borrowed 30 days from the government. And I suspect in 30 more days you'll see another move down as this paper gets refinanced. The result of commercial paper has been that, yes, you've had an uptick, as the chart on the right shows, you've had an uptick in the levels of outstanding financial commercial paper, but we've nowhere near where we were back in September or even earlier this year when these markets were still considered healthy. We've had somewhat of a rebound, and all of that rebound could be attributed to the government. So is commercial paper and LIBOR showing us that the credit markets are getting better? I don't think we could make that case. Repo is definitely not, and there's not as much in the repo market as everything else. If you look at the charts on page 13, again, what's happening is, if you look at the upper left chart, bond market leverage is coming down, that the amount of repo in the market has been shrinking from about $1.6 trillion to $1.1 trillion. $500 billion has come out of the market. The percentage of that repo that is now overnight versus term is the highest it's ever been. Both charts on the bottom show the same thing over different time frames. I wasn't sure which one to use, but I had room, so I decided to stick both of them in there. What is this telling us? Well, first of all, I think a lot of people are looking at the repo number and saying, ah, there's your delevering. You've gone from 1.6 to 1.1. Yes, Wall Street is delevering, but the consequence of that delevering, a bunch of people that were getting loans that shouldn't have been getting loans, they're getting them from the government now. They're not getting them from Wall Street. So while Wall Street's delevering, the economy's not delevering. If you want to think of it in these terms, we have the stylized example I've been using is we have an economy that requires worldwide something along the lines of about $25 trillion in loans every day. We are now providing it roughly $21 trillion worth of loans through the private sector, through the banking system, meaning that there's a hole of $4 trillion. If we were delevering, we would have to have $4 trillion worth of borrowers go away. But we're not. That $4 trillion is being plugged by the government. They're providing the financing for that $4 trillion. Here's the problem. We now have a $21 trillion financial system. It can provide loans for $21 trillion. We have a $25 trillion economy. How are we going to get this in balance? We've got the government standing in the middle trying to hold everything together. Either we need to have investors pump more capital back into the financial system to bring their size up so that we can have them be big enough to provide $25 trillion in loans, or we need to shrink the economy. Or we kind of stay in this kind of stasis in the middle where we are right now, hoping that things get better. And as we do, the problem is the damage done by Paulson with all of his changes in plans and treating the owners of financial firms so badly is extracted a huge toll on the market. Let's move on a little bit more as far as credit goes. Agencies. Let me start with the chart on page 14 in the upper right. 10-year swap spreads, which is in red, which is moving down. 10-year Fannie Mae spreads, Fannie Mae 10 years minus Treasuries, has been dramatically widening. And the reason I express it this way is normally Fannie Mae spreads and swap spreads would trade on top of each other, but now we've opened up a dramatic difference. The bottom chart is 5-year spreads showing something very similar as well, too. Why is this happening? Well, first of all, we gave Paulson his so-called bazooka to try and quell Fannie and Freddie in July, and then we put these companies in the conservatorship in early September, and that was supposed to make their creditworthiness the same as U.S. government's. So why is it that they're getting worse, even though they've gone in the conservatorship? Chart on the left, which was from the TIC update we did earlier this week. The top chart shows U.S. government and agency securities purchases from Asia. In July, August, and September, the last three bars, out of Asia and particularly out of China, you've seen dramatic selling of agency securities. They have turned tail and they have run away from the agency market, and they were a big buyer of these securities. They are not only not a buyer anymore, they are now a big seller of these securities, talking about Asia in particular. And this is through September. We haven't seen the data yet for October, which was that horrific month that we've got coming up yet. We've lost a big buyer. The spreads for agencies are compensating for that loss of buyer. And even conservatorship doesn't change it because the buyer ran away not because he feared the risk, the credit risk of the agencies. Conservatorship increased their credit risk, and it's not changing his view on it. Foreigners have left this market. They're not coming back to this market. It is part of the delevering process. And instead of letting Fannie and Freddie be delevered, we are now putting them into conservatorship, and it's making the situation worse, and the government is preventing them from delevering by trying to step in and trying to keep them afloat. If I go to the next chart, mortgage spreads, I suspect that if you look at this chart, it's all essentially the same thing. The upper left chart is 30-year Fannie Mae minus 30-year Treasuries. Their spread at the current level at around 200 basis points. It's still fairly wide, but this is one of the few markets that's not at a record spread. The bottom chart shows you how you get there, 30-year Fannies and Treasury yields. And the chart on the right is just a longer version of the upper left chart to show you that these levels are the highest levels we've seen in 2+ decades. I suspect that in the next couple of days, as we update this chart, you're going to see mortgage spreads dramatically widen out because of the huge drop that we've had in Treasuries. Treasuries are plummeting lower, down to 315 on the 10-year, down to 372, which is a record on the 30-year. And what we'll see is mortgage spreads have not been plummeting to that degree, and that they're going to widen their spreads back out. Again, a lot of these spreads, when you look at them, they're not getting worse, but they're still definitely a panic level, and it's still way too early to say that things are getting better. Muni spreads on page 16, same chart again. I like to do this a lot with differing time frames. The red chart top is five-year general obligation munis as a percentage of five-year treasuries. At 100, that means that their yield is the same as treasuries. Well above means that at 137, where they are right now, means that they're yielding 137% of treasuries. The blue line is the 10-year GOs versus the 10-year treasury at around 117%. And the bottom chart is 10-year GOs as a percent of treasuries going back 18 years to show you truly how unprecedented what we've seen been happening. Couple of things about this chart. For foreigners, keep in mind, municipals are tax-free. They should, as the bottom chart shows, trade at a much lower yield basis. They should trade at a much lower yield basis treasuries because of their tax-free status. And in normal times, we can use them to try and guess where people think the tax rate is going to go. But in this environment, they're still wider now, if you look at the top chart, than we were when the auction rate security market was blowing up in March when Bear Stearns was going out of business. 5-year, the red line is higher than it was in March. The blue line is higher than it was in March. Munis are still at panic levels. There's no other way around it. Now, why is it that agencies, munis, and mortgages are still at panic levels? I've argued part of the problem is that a big buyer in these markets has always been the levered buyer. And to some extent, we have delevered him out, meaning the hedge fund. And by delevering the hedge fund out of the market, we have had a lot of these players not being able to buy, and it's been really hurting their prices. Page 17, just wrapping up here. Page 17, credit spreads, they're not getting better as well, too. Here's various measures of credit spreads. The top chart shows investment-grade credit spreads. They peaked at 617 back on October 30th. We were at 608 last night. We're just a few basis points off of it. If you look at the bottom left chart, on November 18th, we hit the wide and high yield spreads at 796. We were at 1818 or 1819 or something like that. Yesterday, new records on high yield spreads. If you look at the upper left chart measuring leveraged loans, new low price in the LCDX index. And if you look at the upper or the lower right chart, this is the iTraxx crossover index. The iTraxx crossover index was just about at records, and it shot way over 900 today, so it'd be up off the top of the scale right now. When was the worst level in credit spreads? I've been saying this on these conference calls for a few months now. Today was the worst level in credit spreads. We have the opposite of getting better when it comes to the corporate bond and leverage loan markets. And then finally, the chart on page 18, the stock market, as of yesterday, its decline was double bottoming off of the low of 776 from October of 2002. It was 48% off of its high, whereas in 2002, and it took 2 years versus one this time, we were 49% off of the high. So let me sum all of this up for us. We've had an extraordinary amount of government intervention, numbers so big no one can understand them, larger than the outlays of World War II. This government intervention that we have seen happen here is largely not working, which is why all of these credit spreads are getting worse and the stock market continues to crumble. This has led to scare the hell out of everybody that economic activity all but stopped around October 1st, and we're looking at horrifically bad economic numbers for the fourth quarter. People, yes, have the capacity to buy and to conduct business, but they've elected not to because they're waiting for a sign that things are going to get better. That's what's tripped up the economists. They used to think that if it was this bad, it was because unemployment had skyrocketed. It was because wealth was destroyed. We have had some of that. It was because incomes were down, and you did not have the capacity to spend the money. But this time around you do, you just don't want to, and you're not going to until there's a solid sign that things are getting better, and we don't have that solid sign that things are getting better, and because of that, people are not spending as well. The credit markets can be broken down into two different groups. The medicated markets, which is those with heavy government intervention like LIBOR and commercial paper, nominally they look like they're doing better, but you can't borrow at those rates. You have to use the government as your borrowing partner in terms of the commercial paper market. And we don't know if that is a sign that things are getting better because we only know that once the government withdraws from those markets and they can stand on their own, and they're not withdrawing from those markets. Looking away from the non-medicated markets, whether you look at three-month T-bill rates at 11 basis points, mortgage spreads, agency spreads, muni spreads, corporate spreads, they're all terrible. They're all still at panic levels, and the ABX and the CMBX, which is where everything started in real estate loans packaged as securities, they've taken their worst hit throughout this entire crisis in the last 2 weeks, right about the time that Paulson said they're not going to use the TARP for its original plan. This has all been priced in. This is why we've got levels in markets that we don't understand. Most high-yield managers would tell you they never thought we would see a high-yield index at 1,800 basis points. That's a 21% borrowing rate right now. The stock market is 49% off of its high. We've seen world record rates, whether it's muni spreads, on down the line. So to some extent, we've got a lot of this priced in. And that's why I'll continue to think that a lot of the damage is about to be put into the market. I still look for one more capitulation move in this market that really gets everybody to really move from greed to fear. Normally, what I've been worried about is every time the market sells off, I hear people say, this is a buying opportunity, as opposed to every time the market sells off, you better get out before you have no money left. That's when you get to the fear phase, and I think we're very close to that. At that point, I think we will largely have found a bottom in the market, and yet with all this government involvement and with the idea that we're going to have heavy regulation coming, we're going to regulate out risk-taking, and I don't think we're going to have much of a bounce after that. But I'm going to warn that even though I am kind of saying that we're very close to a low, one, you're still not going to like what it's going to take to get to that low. A great example of that is financial stocks. A lot of people thought that financial stocks by the end of September, they were 41% off their high, and a lot of wise sages said financial stocks are a great buy. They went down 22% in October, and people were floored. It was one of the worst months that financial stocks had ever had, and they said that these represent the most extraordinary value that they've seen ever in the market, financial stocks around November 1st. I heard this a lot on CNBC. That was after 22% down in October. They're down 36% this month, and it's only the 20th of the month right now. So, and what's happened with a lot of these wise sages now is they're in the paper now laying off staff because they've lost so much money as far as these markets go. So you're not going to like the process of making the low, and I am going to say that even though I think we're very close to the low, I am going to rather be a month late than a month early. I'm not interested in picking a low. I'm more interested in saying I think that was the low a few months ago or last month or something along those lines. So the good news is we might be having the damage about over with. The bad news is it's probably going to be sideways, and you're still not going to like the process that's going to come before us. The big problem that we have is that we say we want delevering, but we don't want delevering. We are delevering the private sector and with the losses, but the government is stepping into the breach because delevering means GM goes out of business. Delevering means GE can get commercial paper, but we don't want that. So we're going to give GM a loan. We're going to let GE buy Fed. How do we get out from underneath this? Well, we need people to start having faith in the financial system and start investing in banks and brokers again. The problem there is we've done so much damage with the loose cannon at Treasury, Hank Paulson changing the rules every 3 minutes. No one wants to touch these companies, which is why their stocks are down 36% again this month. It's going to take some time before we can get this problem undone. Last thought for you, and then I'm going to open up for questions, is there's this belief in the marketplace that we haven't found the right deal. And I keep watching everybody and what Paulson is doing. Paulson is an investment banker. He is looking to do a deal. And everybody still has this mentality that somebody's going to come up with a flow chart and a big magic marker and show us how we could structure our way out of this deal. And we're all going to collectively slap our hands on our forehead and say, God, I didn't think of that. That's how we get out of this problem. That doesn't exist. There is no easy way to get out of this problem, and there is no way to get out of it. I was on the phone with a reporter yesterday, and he was saying, if I put you as Zuckerberg, what would you do to fix this problem? And I said, in large part, you really can't, And he wouldn't accept that as an answer. You know, we could do these deals all we want, and we could argue about whether or not we should be modifying mortgages and whether or not we should be, you know, refinancing this or allowing that or creating a new facility here or a new facility there. And that'll stall off the problem for a while, but it's not fixing the problem. And that's really all we can do in this market. All right. As usual, I ran a little bit longer than I thought. 7 pound if you want to ask a question to me directly. Otherwise, if you want to email me a question, or if you're on the webcast, if you want to IM a question, you can do that as well, too. Remember now that we take questions anonymously, so when I answer the questions, I will answer all of these questions in a by first name only. So 7 pound if you want to ask a question online, or you can IM me those questions, or you can email me the question. First question I'll take here. Ryan. Ryan, are you with us?
I am. Thank you.
Sure.
I've got so many questions, but I'll just pick one. Do you think that the market wanted the automotive bailout sort of, you know, without really any strings attached, almost like a blank check? And is that one of the big reasons for the pain we've experienced just in the last few days?
You know, that's a good question. I do think, let me answer the question a little bit more generically. I think one of the problems that we've been facing is another mistake that we've done is we've been trying to both bail out companies and punish them at the same time. AIG is a great example. We'll give you a loan, but you got to give me 80% of the company. And then what happens is we give AIG a loan, and then to show that, you know, we drive a hard deal, we give it to them at LIBOR plus 850, and then they can't pay it back. So our $85 billion goes up to $135 billion, and then the Fed becomes a part owner of the company. If you want to bail out GM, then give them the money to bail them out, and forget belly aching about how much private jet mileage that the CEO puts on the or what he gets paid. If you want to punish them, don't give them the money and punish them. But to try and do this both at the same time, here's $25 billion, but we don't want you to use your private jet and we want to restrict your pay, we showed with AIG that doesn't work. We showed with Fannie Mae that and Freddie Mac, putting them in conservatorship and blowing up the preferred shareholders, that doesn't work. We've proven that doesn't work, and that's what we're doing again. So to answer your question, yes, if you want to bail them out, bail them out. If you want to punish them, punish them. You can't pull off both at the same time. So I do think that that's what's bothering the market, because by attempting to punish these firms and give them money, they're going to be back in 6 months for more money, and they're going to be back a year after that for more money, because we're not going to go about fixing the problem. Ryan, is that kind of get at? Do you have a follow-up to that?
No, that's a good answer. Appreciate it.
Sure, thanks. Let me jump. Next question, and Harold, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you.
Sure.
Can you explain a little bit just in what's going on in the interest rate swaps market? We've got negative spreads on the 30-year, we're almost down, a substantial narrowing in there that's somewhat unprecedented. What's causing this? What's the you didn't really comment on that.
Yeah, you know, the swaps market, the answer is, can I explain it? No, I can't really explain it. It is, you know, negative swap spreads. And, I mean, they're severely negative now, what, by minus 20 basis points or something. They're just not minus one or something along those lines. I can't really explain it other than that, you know, you used to pay a premium for fixed, and now you're paying a premium for floating, I guess, is really what it suggests. You could nominally look at it and say that the market must think that these rates are going to plunge. But beyond that, that one has really been a head-scratcher. You know,
I mean, theoretically, I can buy long treasuries and swap them and pick up spread.
Yeah, exactly.
If
you know,
it's in the repo market, I can earn it on the other side, too.
You know,
assuming somebody will lend to me.
Yeah, you know, assuming somebody will lend to you is a good example. I mean, the answer, the simple answer is this is yet one of these in a long line of things that when markets get stressed like this, they start doing things that you don't quite understand. And I don't understand it. And that's really the best answer I can give you is that it takes an environment like this to get something like negative swap spreads. And why do they exist? They probably exist because those are rates and at levels that you cannot understand, and that you probably cannot do the trade at anyway. So, you know, it could also have something to do with derivatives backfiring. It could have to do with lack of liquidity. All of the above. So, you know, that's kind of the best answer I can give you as far as swap spreads go. But that is one that I've really been, like, scratching my head at. Do you have a follow-up or anything else?
Can I just follow up on something you just said a little while ago with, you know, the whole idea that TARP now is something that is theoretically to put capital into programs. And one of the things, as you said, when they canceled the basically eliminated Fannie and Freddie preferred dividends, they took huge amounts of capital out of regional banks. Because basically they're the big holders of Fannie and Freddie preferred, so they depleted capital, making them an FDIC problem. Why couldn't they right now, or is there anything that prevents them from reinstating the dividend on Fannie and Freddie preferreds, and all of a sudden capital would reappear on the balance sheets of most of the regional banks all across the country?
There's nothing to prevent them from doing that, as far as I know. The problem now is that once you've gotten 2 months on, some of those preferreds might have been sold for residual value so that the regional banks don't own them anymore.
Could be.
But, yeah, you know, but you're right, though. I mean, this gets back to what I said before. Do you want to bail them out or do you want to punish them? You can't do both at the same time. And that's what they tried to do, and that's why it was such a spectacular failure, and that's why I think that this auto thing is going to be a failure, too, because we're trying to do both at the same time.
But in the case of the bank, one way or the other is going to be a government problem, either through the FDIC if it's a problem or the other. Wouldn't it be cheaper to reinstate the dividend, pay it, and have the capital reappear, except for those who have already sold it? I mean, I'm completely
baffled. I think you're right. It is.
Okay.
It is something, you know, if they wanted to reinstate the dividend on the preferreds, it's something that they could do that would maybe help for those regional banks that still own it. They were supposed to put together a program through the FDIC to help those regional banks. I think we call that...
That's an expensive way to do it. You turn around and give it to them so they can merge with a bunch of...
Well, everything they've done, you know...
Never mind, I'm on a soapbox, forget it.
No, you know what? And you're on a soapbox that I get on, too, that everything that they have done to date has not worked. And we know that because of the state of the markets. And part of it has not worked because it's very obvious that it's not thought through. There isn't a plan in action. Early on, I do think if you go all the way back to Bear Stearns, they really thought that the plan was that if we try and remove moral hazard by extracting punishment, that was going to fix the problem. Why do you think the original deal with Bear was $2? That too was meant to be a symbolic gesture that eventually had to be turned up to be 10, but the original $2 a share that they were going to give was supposed to be a symbolic gesture that you were going to get punished.
Yep.
Well, problem is, you know, if you've got firms that are reeling, punishing them makes it worse, and they haven't found a way to both punish and save at the same time. So they're still not quite figuring it out. Even if you go to last week's announcement, I don't have the access that the Treasury Secretary has. And I'm not going to say to you that I could have predicted that the ABX and CMBX markets were going to fall apart if I make an announcement that says I'm not going to do it. But I would have, if I was the Treasury Secretary, would have found out how people thought those markets were going to behave.
Yep.
And unless they completely misjudged those markets, I don't think Hank even thought of asking the question.
Yep.
And because he hasn't thought of asking the question, I think that that's why he got so, you know, blindsided by its answer.
Yeah, they ought to be able to ask the question, what is business as usual, before taking an action? If I take it, will people be able to do business as usual? The answer is no.
Right.
Anyway, I've used up my time. Sorry.
Yeah, thanks, Harold. But just a concluding comment again, I think that the problem here is that we're almost arguing, you know, what could they have done to at least mitigate their damages, not necessarily make things better.
Yeah.
Let me jump to the next question. Thanks again, Harold. To Dan. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm wondering if you have a view on mark-to-market accounting, and while I'm not a fan of changing accounting rules, it seems like we've put ourselves in a position where we're shoving a fat elephant through a keyhole as banks have to pair off some of these assets that they have to write down.
Mark-to-market accounting, by the way, is is also going to hit Mr. Buffett in a big way too with some of the derivatives that he's written, which is why his stock is under extreme pressure. I think, though, to answer your question, we're past it right now. There was a time – let me back up two steps. The reason mark-to-market accounting came into being was it was an outgrowth of the old way we used to do things. The, you know, let's call it the old way was the Enron way. When Enron was doing everything with its special and purpose vehicles and was doing all of its shady accounting in cahoots with Arthur Andersen and got themselves into big trouble, we said that, the old way of hold to maturity available for sale in the trading account, that wasn't working. There was too many examples like SunTrust that was massaging those accounting rules to manipulate their earnings. So we recognized that the old way wasn't working. We went to mark-to-market as to try to fix the old way. But then we went to mark-to-market and we got into this problem where it's the diving market and now it's creating all of these paper losses. I think that the time has come and gone where we could have changed it. If they were to change mark-to-market accounting now, I think it would be terrible for the markets, because what you would be essentially be saying is okay, mark-to-market accounting has made it bad, so let's give you less transparency, not more transparency. And that, I think, would, in this environment, with the mentality that we have in the markets now, would make things worse, not make things better.
It would be more of a just a throwing a just changing the rules yet again and blindsiding people.
Yeah, I think it would definitely be some of that as well too. Last thought for you about mark to market. The problem with mark to market, let's define where the problem is. The problem is with the accountants, with their auditors and their financial statements, the PricewaterhouseCoopers, the Deloitte and Touches of the world. The level three assets is what we're talking about. The rule is management judgment, and the accounting professionals and the SEC has already put out letters a couple of times this year saying that that does not necessarily mean you have to mark these at distressed mark prices. You can use management judgment. The problem is when you get to your auditor, if you want an unqualified statement, they want to use a market measure. And the reason they want to use a market measure is, while they won't say it out loud, the answer is we know what happened with Enron. Enron was using shady accounting, and before we figured out what the accounting was, we seeked out their auditor, and it happened to be Arthur Andersen, and we liquidated the entire accounting firm as a death penalty for the sins of what they did with Arthur Andersen. So no accountant of a financial firm wants to be caught in that situation again. So they're going to go with the most extreme measure to protect themselves. So this, in some respects, is a legacy from the accounting standpoint that we've seen from Arthur Andersen. And if I could throw in one other, you know, kind of anecdotal thing, is I remember that after Bear Stearns went down, a lot of people were saying, you know what, their book value was $83 a share, and they went to zero. We ought to be looking at the accountants and, you know, beating up the accountants. How could they have been carrying them at $83 a share? Well, you're driving the accountants more towards using distressed market prices for level three assets across the entire industry when you start kicking them in the teeth like that, because they're just trying to protect themselves. Because every time a firm gets into trouble, we blame the accountants. So if you wanted to really put where the blame is, you put it where on the accountants. And I understand why they're doing it, because history has shown that if they don't, they could be making career decisions that their firms may not survive, because one of them didn't already. And so that's why they seem to be wanting to do it in terms of that. So it's too late, I think, to change mark-to-market rules right now. They've been trying to ease up with them and say, look, why don't you use more management judgment? It's just that it's using panic levels on the ABX to price this stuff, but you can't get it past the accountants. And the accountants are, you know, probably fearing their life that they actually have to value this stuff because of the downside risks that they face. Dan, did you have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, I did. Real quick, on the final money, on the unspent portion of the TARP, do you think that it should be used for what it was originally intended to do then, to pair off distressed assets from banks and
so we flip yet again back to the I was never a fan of the original plan that buying reverse auctioning these securities to try and put a floor on them was actually a plan that was going to work. But I do think that kind of the flip-flopping around all over the place and selling the TARP as a – remember, we like to laugh internally that there was a email that went around with a picture of somebody holding a gun to a dog's head and said, pass the TARP or this dog dies, and your way of life ends as you know it. Since they weren't able to they sold it to us that way, and then they decided not to do it. Flipping back another way, I think, would almost be as much damage as to any good that could come of it. And besides, I'm not a big fan of it in terms of going back to putting a floor on prices. They seem to be committed to using the rest of the money for capital injections. I'm not sure how they're going to do it. They're not sure. Paulson's not going to ask for the other 350 until the Obama administration comes in, and then we're going to have a whole new Treasury secretary who's going to be in charge of that 350, and we'll see what he winds up doing with it. So,
who do you think that's going to be?
No, if I had to guess right now, I'll guess Geithner will be it, and that's just a pure guess. And if they did put Geithner in as Treasury secretary, then they still have another. There's still another problem along the lines, and that other problem is that the head of the president of the New York Fed is one of the integral players in this game. Geithner, as the New York Fed president, negotiated the AIG bailout. You're going to have to find somebody to replace him at the New York Fed, and that person could almost be as important as the Treasury Secretary. But he's just my guess right now. I don't think they're going to be able to get Summers through from everything that I've read from his problems that he had back at Harvard, talking about women in science. All right, let me move on to the next question. Jack, are you there?
Yes. What data tells you the economy has the capacity to still, even though it doesn't want to, has the capacity to spend and invest, but that in converse, that it's not too much in debt and really doesn't have that capacity?
The data that I have, the only argument I would give you is that the ability of people to spend and invest did not plummet by 30% during the month of October.
Well, what measures that ability? Savings, et cetera?
Income would be the big one. I mean, yes, stock valuations did fall by 22% in October, and they've taken another hit in this month. The S&P 500 is down another 17% in the month of November. So they did take a hit. But if you look at the way that the economy is supposed to work, the big one is income. We did not go from 5% to 12% unemployment in 1 month. We did not have a minus 700 or 800 or million jobs lost for the October payroll report. That would give you that would tell you that people don't have the capacity to spend. What we have is that they voluntarily stopped, that the economy did not decelerate that fast. That's why there's this big debate about how bad the fourth quarter is going to be. Everybody stopped. They could. You know, there are people, I've heard this anecdotally from people, you know, people that have canceled vacations, didn't want to buy a car, people that, stopped looking for a house, even though they could probably still qualify for a mortgage and have the capacity to buy the home. But they decided not to because of all of the uncertainty in the world.
But the only measure is that we didn't go to 25% unemployment.
Well,
income
is definitely the big driver of a lot of these decisions. It's not necessarily savings, at least by the measures that we see now. Now, there should have been a downdraft because of the hit in savings. But the huge deceleration that we've seen since October 1st over September was really more that of a confidence issue. Now, I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination that the economy, if everybody spent to their capacity, that the economy would be okay. But what I am suggesting is that the numbers Right now, I've seen some estimates of -4% to -6% GDP numbers for the fourth quarter of 2008. Now, half the quarter still has to go. If we have numbers in that range, it'll be among one of the worst quarters we have ever seen in our career in terms of economic growth for the fourth quarter. It is that bad. But and a lot of it is because of this voluntary stoppage. Now, if we didn't have this voluntary stoppage, we'd still probably have a terrible quarter somewhere around zero, but we wouldn't have it 400 or 600 basis points worse than that. That's what I'm arguing about, is that everybody looked at, we needed the TARP pass because it was our way of life depended upon it, and then the stock market responded by going down 3,000 points, and everybody said, that's it, I'm not going to buy a car, I'm not going to buy a house, I'm not going to expand my business, I'm not going to do anything, I'm going to wait until a sign that tells me that everything's okay. And here it is November 20th, and we're still waiting for that sign, and everybody's still kind of just standing there doing nothing, waiting for something to happen.
Well, my point is you can still have a job, so you have employment, but
right.
You can be so hocked up that you can't get into any economic activity, buy, invest, or anything. And so unemployment may not be a good enough indicator to tell that we still have the capacity to spend and invest.
Right. But what you're arguing is a more of a longer-term thing, and I'm not disagreeing with you that could be a sign that things are getting worse. But I would argue to you that it did not change from September 29th to October 14th that fast.
Maybe private debt would be a good measure, whether that has gone up so high.
Well, it did. The problem with the private, yes, it is, and it was, but the problem with private debt is that, you know, Stan Salvickson was correct when he was pointing out in the 1980s that it was too high, and it kept going higher for the next 20 years. So, yes, the problem with a lot of those measures is they were measures that told us that when we got into trouble, that they were going to show us that we had a huge decline coming. And now that we've gotten into trouble, they are showing us, indeed, that we've got a huge decline coming.
Uh-huh.
All right, let me jump from there, Jack. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
And let me just conclude here with a couple of the questions that came in on the audiocast side. I've got a lot of emails with questions, 42 of them to be exact. So I'll try and answer those questions afterwards via email, and I'll try and include, as I always do, I'll include them in the transcript that we'll put out Monday. But for some of these audiocast questions, first one from Milton, can we not consider the trade below 776 as a breakdown similar to the breakdown in October of 1930, which led to a further bear market? Now, he wrote that early on when we were under 776 and we're now at 800. And the answer is possibly if we were to seriously break through 776, you could be looking at that from a technical standpoint and saying, hey, this is the first lower low that this market has had in many, many decades, and that might be a sign that, you know, we've got a 1930-style depression coming. Otherwise, I'm sure that with us trading at 798 right now, you're going to hear the double bottom talk. The next question is from Jeffrey. With lower CMBX marks, what is the impact on year-end marks for many financial institutions? Does it wipe out the new capital injected into these markets? It's going to be bad if it stays down at these levels. There is going to be another round of losses, especially on CMBX. ABX, I don't think, is going to be as big a problem because so much of that stuff has been written down already and so much of that stuff has been sold off. But I think your question is right that there is going to be another round of write-downs because if the CMBX market continues to stay as weak as it has in those charts that we showed, then I think that we've got a real problem on our hands, and it could be somewhat of an issue. And your follow-up question to that was, what are the chances we see mark-to-market reform? Boy, we got to be very careful if we wanted to start to do mark-to-market reform, because of the dive in the CMBX index. Because if we did mark-to-market reform now, it would be viewed as a sign that we are trying to cover up a loss, and I don't think that would be taken over very good. Bob has a question. What will it take for the leveraged loan market to stabilize and not to continue to move lower? The leveraged loan market is going to stabilize when all the other markets stabilize. The market is going, all of these markets are going to peak at the same time. All of these markets are going to trough at the same time. It gets back to that, it gets back to that one slide that we've had that is on page 9, that it's all the same trade. Everything is moving together. I could have stuck so many other indicators underneath that 10-panel chart, including leveraged loans, that would have shown a very similar correlation to the S&P 500. What's going to make it return in general is relending. The banks get capitalized. Confidence comes in enough that people want to invest in the banks. They get recapitalized and they start lending, and the market starts to bottom out and it starts to move forward. But is something specific to leveraged loans going to stop it? No, I don't think so. I think they're going to all turn at the same time. Andy has a question. Where do you see investment-grade corporate spreads peaking, and are we there yet? Well, we're at a little over 600 basis points right now in the Merrill Investment Grade Index. I think we're very close to it, but, you know, in this environment with this volatility, that could still be another 150 basis points higher. I mean, you know, that used to be what we considered wide for junk just a year ago, and now that's investment grade. But I still would contend to you that 600 basis points, and I've seen some measures using Moody's, that these are like the widest spreads we've seen in something like 60 years in terms of corporate spreads, have discounted a lot of the damage, and we could still see further moves. So when we get to the wide, that's why I was using that 150 basis point number, you may not like the final move to get to the wide, but it still could be coming. Finally, last question I'll take here is from Phil. What do you think about gold as a play on the global lack of faith in the U.S. Treasury and at the other end of the extreme back-end inflation that actions may bring late next year? The problem with gold is that gold in generic terms is a good play on all of the problems. That's why I think it's held up relatively well. Relatively well, meaning that while a lot of commodities like gold have gone down, I mean by crude oil, are down by more than half, copper is down by more than half. Gold has gone from 1,000 to 750, so it's down by a third or a quarter. It's down, but it's not nearly down as much. The problem with gold is it's much a financial asset as it is a physical asset, and that as a financial asset, it's being caught up in a lot of this as well, too. One case in point, one of the buyers of gold is the GLD, the gold ETF. It is at one point earlier this year, it would have been the fourth largest central bank holding of gold in the world because it had nearly 700 tons of gold. We're relying on financial buyers to buy gold ETFs, and if they're being battered around by the credit crisis, it helps to hurt gold as well, too. As far as the second half of your question goes, back-end inflation, I've been a big proponent of that argument that what you see in the Federal Reserve chart and what you see what the Federal Reserve has been doing with their balance sheet, which is that upper left chart on page 6, going from $800 billion to $2.2 trillion, that number is nothing short of Weimar Republic type inflation is what you're seeing there. But it's not working, so we have deflation. But boy, oh boy, the day that some of this stuff ever starts to work, we're going to have an inflation problem. The Fed will try and withdraw all this liquidity before inflation gets out of hand, and that's going to be a big high wire act that I just wonder how they're going to be able to pull that off. So I do agree with you, though, that on the other end of the extreme, back-end inflation, yes, we are going to have back-end inflation with a lot of these actions once traction starts getting and the credit crisis starts evolving. Is it next year, end of next year, or is it 2010? That's the open question. All right, let me stop there. I'll try and answer some of the other questions, and I'll include those in the transcript, which we will send out Monday. If you've got any other thoughts or questions, go ahead and email me on it. Thank you all, and join us again next month. Bye-bye.